I want to begin by asking a couple of questions. Have you ever been betrayed by someone close to you? Think for a moment. Have you ever been betrayed by someone close to you? Or a different way of asking a similar question would be, have you been abandoned or rejected by someone that you really cared about, that you really loved? Have you ever had that happen to you? Most of the people I would venture to say in this room have gone through that kind of experience before, maybe multiple times. How did you respond? Think for a moment. I don't want to hear out from shouting out, but how did you respond? Did you respond in loving forgiveness and receive them, or did you, you know, withdraw and walls up and protection? This idea of betrayal is a popular one in literature. I don't know if you've noticed that in literature and in movies. Notable ones that I can think of are in the movie Gladiator. Emperor Marcus Aurelius is betrayed by his own son and killed by his own son to take the crown of Rome at that point in time. Then you have Delilah and Samson. There's a famous betrayal, right? And then another one might be in the movie Braveheart. These are manly kind of movies, you know, that I'm referring to. But you've got Robert the Bruce, who was an ally of William Wallace, and then betrayed him, and it crushed him. But more than anything else, even in secular literature, if you asked a secular journalist, if you say, "What's the story of the greatest betrayal of all time?" This one would be it. It would be, even in the ears of secular people, this story rings out. This kind of betrayal. And in this passage that we're looking at today, I want us to focus in on what John is trying to communicate, and that is this, that even with the deep sting of betrayal and the abandonment of a close friend, Jesus calls us into radical self-giving love. And that is to be the thing that we are known by, the main thing that we're known by. So let me say that one more time. Even with the deep sting of betrayal and the abandonment of a close friend, Jesus still calls us into radical self-giving love as the main thing that we are known for. Now, Jesus knows and feels the betrayal of an inner circle friend, and in this case, and then he predicts that Peter is going to, who's a BFF. Peter is a best friend forever kind of a person with Jesus. He's one of the inner circle three, and he knows he's going to be betrayed. He knows he's going to be denied, and yet he does not shy away from loving, which is really extraordinary, that he knows that through these devastating relational issues that God is going to work something powerful, something redemptive, that is going to affect every one of us even to this day. But this devastating event is something that had to happen. Now, these two hard events within this passage, the betrayal of Judas and the abandonment, if you will, the denial of Peter, they sort of sit in as the two dark, hard pieces, and the soft thing like an Oreo in the middle is the love command that Jesus gives us. Now, the context of this is that 5 days before, Jesus rode into Jerusalem on a donkey, a very humble entry for this would-be Messiah king. This is Thursday of that same week. It is only hours before Jesus is going to be handed over to the authorities. He's going to be tried and beaten and killed. It is the Passover. And the Passover feast was when the people of Israel, it was one of the pilgrimage feasts where the pilgrims came from all over Palestine to be able to celebrate God's miraculous deliverance of the Jewish people from slavery in Egypt. And now, God is about to do this, a very, very different and more powerful freedom of slavery thing, if you will. That he is setting up his own sacrifice, and that's going to be the sacrifice of his one and only son. Now, as you saw in the movie clip, that they are in an upstairs room in a house in Jerusalem. And This is just in the concluding hours of Jesus' earthly life. And we see in those concluding hours that at least four things are going on. Firstly, there's a squabble that goes on between the disciples about who's going to get the best seats once Jesus becomes king. They, obviously McFly, don't get it. Then he washes their feet, setting a brand new kind of servant DNA in as the primary genetic code of the whole movement. And he's doing something more than that. He's revealing to them what it means to be Lord by washing their feet, and then what it's going to mean to be the followers of that Lord going forward. Thirdly, we see that Jesus will take the elements, some of the elements of the last of the Passover feast, in particular the bread and the wine, and he will reinterpret those in a very different kind of freedom narrative. And he's going to reinterpret those as a new freedom for the slavery that has always enslaved people on this planet. And then lastly, in this particular set of circumstances, Jesus is going to set this whole thing up to give them the final instructions that they're going to need to live in the absence of his physical presence on earth. Not the absence of his presence, but the absence of his physical presence on earth. And so that's the rest of the book of John from here or until the passion narrative when Jesus is going to be killed. That's what's going on up until this point in time. Now, this particular passage comes right on the heels of Jesus washing their feet, and this is where it goes, and we're going to pick up at verse 18. But he finishes the foot washing by saying, now that you know these things, that is washing one another's feet, you will be blessed if you do them. Then in verse 18, he says, I am not speaking of all of you. I know whom I have chosen, but the scripture will be fulfilled. He who ate my bread has lifted his heel against me. I am telling you this now before it takes place, so that when it does take place, you may believe that I am he. Now, important to say here as we're reading through this, that Judas's betrayal does not catch Jesus by surprise, not at all. That God is going to use this evil intent, and he's going to use it to accomplish something very powerful. He's going to use it in his larger purposes. Hear me now. This is the seed, one of the seeds that I'm trying to sow here, is that something very bad is going to happen. It doesn't catch God by surprise, and it's used for something greater to occur in people's lives. And this is a very common narrative of the way that God works with all of us, but this in particular is what's going on here. And he says in verse 20, truly, truly, I tell you, whoever receives the one I send receives me. And whoever receives me receives the one who sent me. So the foot washing Lord is sending out his foot washing motley crew to do the things that he has done. They're going to represent him on his errand, on his mission. That's how the mission is going to continue, is not by Jesus staying on the earth, but by Jesus bequeathing the authority and the mission to these guys. These guys, in turn, are going to give it to other people who are going to give it to other people who are going to give it to other people who are going to give it to us. And so we have this same mission that Jesus is giving us, that we are, and it's important to note here that this isn't just anybody who receives us receives Jesus. It is these. He's saying, you go in my name, on my errand, and the people that receive you, it's going to indicate that the Father is doing something there. That the reception that you receive will show that God has already been at work and preparing these things, these people. Now, Peter encountered this in a powerful way in Acts 10. I don't know if you remember that, but Peter's thinking that the gospel is just for Jewish people. And he is up on a roof praying one day. He has this crazy, bizarre vision. And then at the end of the vision, basically the gist of the vision is saying that actually these Gentile people that you don't want anything to do with, I love them. And I want you to receive them. As soon as he comes out of the vision, there's a knock on the door. It's a couple of Gentile people. They receive Peter in a way that they're receiving Jesus by receiving him. And as a result of them receiving him, this powerful encounter with God comes on the heels of that. This is the way that God has designed it. And he has made us people for whom the world contacts and experiences him if we get this love dynamic. That's one of the things that Maddie was talking about. She just got loved. She came into this youth group and got loved. It's what happened to me. I grew up in the church, but I didn't know Jesus. Then I got into this youth group, and people just loved me and loved me and loved me. And I'm like, what on earth is this? I like it. I want more of this. And I need this Jesus in my own life. This same thing that Jesus is saying to them applies to us as well. Verse 21. After saying these things, Jesus was troubled. He was troubled in his spirit. And he testified, "Truly, truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me." Eating stops. Everyone stops in their tracks. What? We're riding the wave of public opinion here. What? We've been with you for almost 3 years, Jesus. What? And he says this to them. He said, He says, the disciples looked at one another, uncertain of whom he spoke. One of the disciples, whom Jesus loved, was reclining at table at Jesus' side. And so Simon Peter motioned to him to ask Jesus of whom he was speaking. I thought it was curious in the video. It's like he's saying this across the room, like, "Hey, John, ask him." It's like, you know, he's right there. But what's interesting is that Jesus doesn't balk at all. He actually, John leans over and asks Jesus, and Jesus answers in it very candidly. It's he to whom I give this morsel of bread when I have dipped it in. So when he dipped the morsel, he gave it to Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. And after that, he had taken the morsel, Satan entered him. So we know from John's gospel that Judas was greedy, but now he's demonized. Now he's something else has happened. And the devil will try to derail the plans of God. He will try to get the upper hand. He will try, and in this he's trying to destroy Jesus, thinking that in destroying Jesus, he can destroy the whole movement. He doesn't understand that, so to speak, God is doing sort of a judo move here. That is, he's taking the force of the assailant and using it against the assailant. And that's exactly what Jesus is doing here, that God is actually going to take the full force of the assailant, and it's going to provide a powerful kickback on this. And Jesus said to them then, what you are going, this is Jesus to Judas, what you are going to do, do quickly. No one at the table knew why he had said this to him. Some thought because Judas had the money bag, Jesus was telling him, but buy what you need for the feast, or that he should give something to the poor. So after receiving the morsel of bread, he went out immediately. And I like the way that John finishes this little sentence. He says, and it was night. It was night. Over and over again, the theme throughout the book of John is that light has come into the world, but people loved darkness instead of light. So John is still using this language to say that light has come, but Jesus has just been saying it's about to get very dark, very, very dark. Now let's just pick up three things that we see from here, and there are 6 points, and that's three more than I normally would do, but I just couldn't pare it down, so bear with me here, all right? And I'm not going to illustrate all of them really deeply, but I think they're all important. The first one that we see here is that only minutes before, Jesus had washed his betrayer's feet. He washed Judas's feet. He had invested 3 years into Judas. He had loved him. He'd befriended him. He served him. He poured his life into him, knowing this is the one who will betray me. All of these things Jesus knew, and yet he loved him anyway. I mean, what kind of love is that? That's incredible, self-giving, concrete love that we don't see that on earth, not very often at least, and you see Jesus doing that. Now, many of us have felt the sting, that deep sting of betrayal before, and our hearts have been broken by it, but our responses most of the time are not like Jesus' response. We don't lean into and love the people that are going to betray us or have betrayed us. We get gun shy. We sort of opt for protection. If I'm bruised over here, I don't want to make sure that I don't let you into any of these places where I'm bruised. And so we kind of protect the places that we're bruised. But then we get bruised here, and then we put this port forward, and then we get bruised there, and so it's like, well, then we do this, and that bruise, and honestly, a lot of us are sort of doing this thing wherever we go because we're trying to keep from being hurt by everyone else, and that is what is dictating the direction of our lives and our love. And Jesus is challenging that. This is not the way that Jesus treats us when perhaps we do the same thing with him. And so I want to ask you for a moment, close your eyes and hear the water poured on your feet. Hear the whistling rasp of the whip as it comes into Jesus' back. Hear the nails pound through flesh. Hear the wheeze of his last breath. This is self-giving love. This is love. This is love. Even to those who would betray him. Secondly, that in the midst of all this, God is still at work. Fully knowing that betrayal and abandonment are drastically in the mix, betrayal cannot stop God's good purposes. Let me say that one more time. Betrayal cannot stop God's good purposes. That instead, in this case, God is using this devastating event to accomplish something, as we said, powerful and liberating. This is the way that Jesus works. That he takes the rubble of all these other things that have gone on in our lives and he recomposes us, so to speak. In the book of Nehemiah, it's an Old Testament book in the Bible, God's people have returned from exile in Babylon. But they've come back to a city of Jerusalem that lies in ruins. The walls are completely crushed and completely all, they've been laid waste. That's the way that they say it. And their job is to rebuild this wall. But the way that the Lord gives them the commission is that they rebuild the wall with the old stones. And they take the old stones and they begin to rebuild it. And rebuild it, and rebuild it, and rebuild it with the old rubble. I remember just spur of the moment here. There was a movie called Joshua. It's the movie of the book by Joseph Garzoni. And in the book, there's a woman whose life has been crushed. She lost her husband, and after that, to a car accident. After that, she just had no hope for anything, and she came to Jesus, and Jesus was going to give her this, or I think she was going to give Jesus this, the Jesus person in the story, this glass pitcher, and as she comes to him, she has the wrong idea about who Jesus is and thinks that he cares about her in some sort of romantic way, and she drops the pitcher and leaves from there because he does set her straight. I don't love you that way, but I love you more than you ever could imagine. Later on in the story, Jesus brings her the glass pitcher with all the pieces completely put together, but all of the pieces are there. And I think it's a beautiful picture because this is the way that the Lord works with us. That you might think, my life is just nothing but rubble. But our God can do something with rubble. In fact, perhaps he does his best work with rubble because it's all we give him, honestly. And so that's the second thing, that God is, that the betrayal and these relational losses cannot stop God's good purposes. Thirdly, that God feels the deep sting of betrayal. He feels it. And he still pours out his love. It says in this that Jesus is deeply troubled in his spirit. that he feels the pain of his own betrayal. In this particular case, it's likely that it's not for everyone else. He feels the sting of this betrayal of a person who's sitting practically right next to him. And it hurts. This is the same word that is used when Jesus experienced Lazarus' sisters and their broken hearts when Jesus shows up a little bit late in their opinion to where Lazarus is and Lazarus has died. And it says that when Jesus comes into contact with them, that his heart is deeply troubled. It's the same thing that's going on now, except for now it is his heart that is breaking. He knows he's about to be stabbed in the back by someone he loves. This is the one who sits with you in your pain. This is the one. This is the one who puts his arm around you, holds you in an embrace, and does not let go. This is that one. This is that one who is completely and utterly trustworthy. In the midst of everyone else who isn't, Jesus is. He is the one who steps into your world, into your pain, and he's the one that puts his hand on your heart, and your heart starts beating once more, and you're able to love again. Now, some of you came into this place today just feeling like, I want to be in the place where God is, but I don't have any love to give to anybody. It starts with receiving love from him. So beautiful what Maddie said, that she just started to experience this kind of love and it changed her. But this is our Jesus. This is our Jesus. Then in verse 31, he says this. When he had gone out, Judas, Jesus said, Now is the Son of Man, which is how he refers to himself, glorified. And God glorified in him. And if God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself and glorify him at once. So a number of things that are being said here. One, firstly, is that Jesus sees that now that Judas has gone off on his errand, that now the wheels are in motion, that Jesus is going to actually... He is going to commit the ultimate act of self-giving love. He's going to give his life for you and I, for our sins, on the cross. And somehow, that from God's point of view, this is glorious. This death is glory. It's not just the resurrection is glory. The death is glory too, to God. Why? Because death says, I love you that much. Death says, this is the lengths I'm willing to go to rescue you from slavery of your own making. This is love. And so you might say it this a little bit differently, that glory would be what a person is known for, their reputation. And so when Jesus says, I'm going to be glorified, this is what I am going to be known for. And it's shaped like that. That's what I'm going to be known for. That I'm going to be known for this kind of sacrificial love, and we have symbols of that that have continued to radiate in our world ever since then. And then he shifts gears in a very interesting and curious way. It's very tender because he says to them, little children, yet a little while I'm with you, and you will seek me. And just as I said to the Jews, so now I say to you, where I am going, you cannot come. He knows that they cannot go to the cross, that they cannot endure this kind of self-sacrificial love for the sins of the world. He knows that they can't do that. But then he doesn't shift gears. Actually, he says, so what you can do is this, a new command I give you, that you love one another. Just as I have loved you, in the same manner, the same kind, that kind of love, that same kind of expression, you also are to love one another. By this, all people will know that you are my disciples, that you love one another. Now, loving God is not a new command, right? Nor is loving others a new command. There's nothing new about that. Jesus has already reiterated that in Matthew 22. He said, these are the two greatest commands. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. But then, and love your neighbor as yourself. The law hangs on all these things. Everyone knows that. What's different about what Jesus is saying here is that it is the way I have loved you. That's the difference maker here. That's the thing that transforms this kind of love from something that perhaps people can pull off in their own strength, and what you can't. You can only pull this off by being loved by God and then giving out of what you got. This is self-giving, foot washing, laying down your life, seed going into the ground and dying kind of love. And this is what we're called into. This is what he calls them into and us as well. Now, let's be clear, firstly, from where Jesus starts. He says, a new command I give you. That loving others the way that Jesus has loved us is not a request. It is a command. It's a command. Not a request. Not a suggestion. And when God commands something of us, he does so because if we align ourselves and our lives with that, it opens us, it allows us to walk safely under his care. It allows us to walk in his blessing. It allows us to walk in his fullness. That's what the commands are all about. So if I say to one of my children, I don't want you to put your hand over the open flame on the stove, I'm not inhibiting their freedom. I'm looking out for them. Right? Right? And these commands that God has given us, don't commit adultery, that's looking out for us. Right? All of those things are God saying, here, if you live within these boundaries, you'll be safe. If you don't, you'll get torched. And what we do is we say, I'm good with being torched. And then we get torched. It's like, what are you doing? But this is often, I think, where we go. But this is a command. It is not a suggestion. Further, that Jesus' style of self-giving love is what we are to be known for. And so I must ask this question. What are you known for? What are you known for? If that question was to be asked about me, if I'm honest, I think that some people would say Bob is all about getting good deals. It is my superpower. That I'm about good. I'm a deal hound. I can find good deals. It's a spiritual gift. Or some of you might say Bob is about cool guitars or about intimate rock worship. Or perhaps Bob is about church history and the Trinity. Now we're moving in the right direction, perhaps. But is it he's known for self-giving love? I don't think so. What about you? What about you? What are you known for? I think the church in America has lost its way on this, quite frankly. I think we criticize, we divide, we argue, we judge, we politicize, we moralize, we hold grudges, we hurl insults, we say one thing, we do another. Self-giving love, not so much. Not so much. And I believe that Jesus is here today, hand extended, saying, I am the on-ramp back into a life of love. But you're going to have to step out of the world of me to get into this. And he does this even knowing that he's going to be betrayed. And he says, I want you to love each other. And he looks at Peter and he knows that Peter's going to deny him. And he says, love each other. And Peter's, and I like the guy's face in that because it's like, this kind of hurts. And Jesus has said some things to Peter that actually kind of cut him deeply. But he's also going to be the guy that sets a significant portion of the DNA of the church, of the movement. And this is important. And Peter, I'm so impressed and encouraged by that Jesus actually used Peter, and he gets the keys of the kingdom. He gets to be this kind of the point leader for the whole church. And this is a guy that's so much like me. He is foot insert in mouth kind of a person. He's the kind of person who says things and is really bold and sometimes really not a lot of substance to it. And that same guy who's going to deny Jesus three times before the cock crows, Jesus is going to give the keys to the car, and the car is the church. But here, Pete contests. Lord, where are you going? Now, remember, before we go finish this out, think with me for just a moment. These guys have put all their eggs in the Jesus basket. They have ridden into Jerusalem with great fanfare and everything, and Jesus is saying, Jesus is saying these things that really just don't make any sense with regard to what they think and how this is going to turn out. They don't see it. And somebody betraying Jesus? What? What? Peter says, Lord, where are you going? And Jesus answers, where I am going, you cannot follow me now, but you will afterward. And Peter said, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. And I imagine Jesus' compassion in his eyes. Will you lay down your life for me? I tell you the truth. The rooster will not crow till you have denied me three times. Now, most of you in this room know how the story plays out. Peter denies Jesus three times. One of the things I think we failed to mention is that in Luke's gospel, they are in the same courtyard, and Peter is on one side of the courtyard, and Jesus is perhaps, where the door is over there, and Peter's warming himself, and he finally, when he does the final denial, I don't know the man, and his eyes and Jesus' eyes meet right then and there. Yow. Ouch. Now, I relate to Peter in that because it's like, what would that feel like? But what would it feel like for Jesus in that? Their eyes meet. The one who has loved him and served him and washed his feet that very night. And so what we see here is that God knows that we will fail him. He does know that. And he still loves us. Believes in us. And gently restores us. I have to add to that, though, however, that he does this calling us back to loving him and following him. He doesn't just restore us just to say so that we just feel better. He restores us back to good followership. He restores us back into mission. He restores us back into our true identity. And that identity is caught up both in being loved by God and loving others and loving radically. And so what I believe that Jesus is saying to us this day is he's calling us back into love. He's calling us back into his love. Because some of you, you just are busy, just like, again, like Maddie said, we're busy serving, we're busy trying to be perfect, we're busy doing all these different things, thinking that if we do these things that God is going to like us better, he's going to love us more, and none of those things change it. He has already decided how much he loves you. That is settled. Once and for all. And the statement of that is with the symbol right behind me. The cross is the symbol, the icon of self-giving love. That's how much you are loved. And so Jesus calls us back into love from him, love for him, love for others, love for those who are far from him, and even love for those who betray us or we know will, and those who will hate us. Love for all of them. That is the Christian message. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Turn the other cheek. This applies to the neighbor from hell or the boss from hell or the teenager living in your own household from hell. that can feel like that, right? And this is all of that bunched into one statement. And so let me just reiterate and close here that Jesus washed the betrayer's feet. He washed Judas's feet. That betrayal cannot stop God's good purposes. It can't. It never has been able to, and it never will. That God feels the deep sting of betrayal, and he still pours out his love, and he's the model. That loving others the way that Jesus loved us is not a request, it's a command. That Jesus-style self-giving love is not what we, is what we are to be known for, and all the rest of this is that God knows that we will fail him. He loves us, he believes in us, he gently restores us, but he calls us back into love for him and to following him. As I was thinking about stories that typify this idea, one of my favorite stories came to mind. It is Victor Hugo's Les Miserables. I think I'm saying that right. Miserables. And the first time I saw it, I'm like, how did this story get by me? At one point, it chronicles the life of a man named Jean Valjean. And he goes and steals some bread to be able to feed his family. He's thrown into prison. He's on a rock pile for years and years and years. Finally, he's let out of prison. I'm not even sure if he's legitimately let out of prison. He is trying to avoid the cops at all costs. A priest takes him in to his home in a small village. Overnight, as Jean Valjean gets up, he goes to steal all of the silver that's in the priest's cupboard, and he's putting the things into a bag to be able to escape with it, and the priest confronts him, of which he assaults the priest and flees with the goods. The next day, he is caught by the constables, and they bring him back to the priest. And you're thinking in this, he's going to get his comeuppance. But what ends up happening is the police say, is this your silver? And the priest says, yes, officer, that's very definitely our silver. He said, well, did this man take your silver from you? And he said, actually, no, he didn't. I actually asked him to take all of it, and he didn't take all of it. And so let me go get the rest of it and put it into here so that he can have all of it. Here's a man who's been betrayed, who's been stolen from, and does not respond in kind. Instead, he responds in Christ. And because of that, Jean Valjean's life has changed. This radical mercy just lit him up. And he becomes a model citizen, helping everyone that he can possibly help, loving people well, because love and mercy have become real to him. And this is Jesus for us right now. Will you receive? Would you pray with me, please?